Welcome to New Orleans. Sorry it's not warmer for you all. This seems to happen when people come to visit. So my name is Megan Neismer. I'm the food sourcing specialist at Second Harvest Food Bank of Greater New Orleans. I also serve as the volunteer executive director of the New Orleans Fruit Tree Project. I'm going to talk a little bit today about those two organizations, the Fruit Tree Project and Second Harvest Food Bank, and just talk a little bit about the roles that they play in food rescue. They differ very much in their context and their capacity. So I have no relationships to disclose. I'm sure no one will be surprised about these numbers. Louisiana is notorious for being the best of the worst in a lot of categories. So unfortunately, our poverty rate sits at about 20%, 9% in extreme poverty. 16.5% of people in Louisiana are food insecure. It's about 1 in 6 people. 28% child poverty rate, 47th in the country, and about 404,000 children who are within families that are SNAP, that receive SNAP benefits. 31% of the jobs in the state are considered low wage. I have Southern Louisiana as the title here, but this really applies to the majority of the state. We have very low population density. There's about 4.5 million people in the whole state of Louisiana. Some of the major urban areas are New Orleans, of course. We have the Lafayette area, Alexandria, Monroe, Thibodaux area are higher concentrations of people, but the majority of our parishes are considered rural. And that is a challenge when you're talking about food insecurity and food distribution, because you need to meet a large number of people, that 1 in 6, but they happen to be spread out all over the place. So food insecurity in the food banking world, lack of access to enough food for an active, healthy life for all household members. And I think that all household members is important because when we speak to a lot of our clients at the food bank, there might be a family member that is getting adequate nutrition. That probably means someone else is foregoing a meal or two. Systemic issues that lead to food insecurity, low-wage jobs and lack of economic opportunity, rising costs of food, housing, and utilities, a lack of education, which is going to feed into your lack of economic opportunity, and availability of affordable food sources. And I'm sure everyone's heard about food deserts, particularly food deserts after Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans particularly. So there's responses to food insecurity. Food assistance and emergency food distribution, which is what a food bank meets the needs of. Education, which is also something that Second Harvest provides. You have this national program called Cooking Matters. It actually teaches people how to cook on a budget and familiarizes them with cooking. That seems to be a lost art for a lot of people. Social services assistance is a huge component of increasing food access, increase the SNAP benefits, Medicaid. If you're spending less on your health care costs, probably means you can spend more on food. LHCHIP is actually a health insurance for any child under the age of 19 in Louisiana who is not insured through their parents. Another response to food insecurity is home and community garden, which is where the New Orleans Fruit Tree Project steps in. This is a program I developed in 2011 while I was in AmeriCorps Vista at Holly Grove Market and Farm. And Holly Grove Market and Farm is a market in New Orleans that's 100% dedicated to providing local products. So they work with all local farmers. I think it's within a 100-mile radius. When I was there, we would get calls from people that was just in the greater New Orleans area saying, I have a citrus tree and it has so much fruit. Do you want to come get it? And it was kind of like, well, no, we're a market. That's not really what we do. But since I was AmeriCorps and you kind of just do what you're asked, I got a ladder in our van and I started going to collect this fruit. And it was insanely popular. In our first season, which got a late start, we harvested 3,000 pounds of fruit. And it all went to Second Harvest Food Bank, weirdly, where I wasn't working yet. And so I should say that there's a rich history of backyard gardening and home orchards in New Orleans. This is just something that people did. And it's probably not unique to New Orleans. That was something people did across the country. But the remnants of that time are beautiful and bountiful citrus trees all over our city. So the Fruit Tree Project, the majority of the activity is from November to March, and this is citrus season for our area. And this is really just unique to the South Shore of this area. You don't see really citrus in too many other places in the state. Let's see here, where was I? Oh, so at this time, 4 years later, the New Orleans Fruit Tree Project has harvested over 30,000 pounds of fruit from the city. We have very low overhead. We have a nice white Ford Windstar that we drive around. And we fruit tree owners contact us through our website. We have a team of volunteers that will go out, harvest the fruit, and then that fruit goes to Second Harvest Food Bank, Tulane Community Health Center, which actually sets out free fruit in their waiting room for patients to take home. And at this time, we have about 150 fruit tree owners registered with us. When citrus season gets close, we send out messages and asking them to let us know when their fruit's ready. And you can see our 300-plus volunteers that are registered. People love to volunteer. this is huge. I mean, we've grown very organically over the last 4 years. You know, we started with 3,000 pounds. The year next, we did 10. The year after that, we did 10,000. And actually, last year, we had a really rough winter, which I think the whole country did. So our numbers were a little bit lower than normal. So now that we've gotten really good at harvesting fruit, our next plan was to start putting more trees in the ground. And this is a new project. It's actually going on right now for this fall. It's called Planting for the Future. And this is something that we're in partnership with New Orleans Area Habitat for Humanity, and our goal is to plant 100 fruit trees across the city. And the partnership with Habitat for Humanity is important because I had a sneaking suspicion over the last few years that there were entire neighborhoods that we were missing out and harvesting. And I wasn't sure at the time whether it was because they didn't know about us. You know, different social media outlets. The local food movement is definitely concentrated in some areas more than others. And so, you know, I had these suspicions. Or there was just no trees there, which in some of these neighborhoods, which, you know, could be for a multitude of reasons. And then there was also the possibility that there were so many trees in these neighborhoods, but people knew how to utilize it, and they were sharing it with their family and friends, and that's why they weren't calling us. But I decided to err on the side of caution and assume that there weren't fruit trees in some of these neighborhoods. So with our partnership with Habitat for Humanity, you can see these dark blue neighborhoods here. It could be more of our lower socioeconomic neighborhoods. We've never harvested a single tree in any of those neighborhoods. Conveniently, that's where Habitat for Humanity has their homes. So they sent out letters to their homeowners. And we had 50 homeowners respond asking for a fruit tree. So this fall we'll be putting 50 fruit trees in those neighborhoods, and in the spring we'll be doing the same thing. So far, so good. So I see planting for the future. Our goal is to add to the decimated urban canopy. Prior to Katrina, New Orleans was a Tree City USA. We had a very healthy urban canopy. You know, we were right up there with other urban areas as far as our tree coverage. But following Katrina, due to wind damage, salination, and a lot of debris removal, when trees just got damaged as homes and roads and everything were being pulled out, we lost a lot of that. Now we're considered one of the worst urban canopies in the country. So we're hoping our little fruit trees will add to that. We're hoping to increase access to fresh fruit to low-income households. And we're, you know, if people don't use the fruit that's growing on their tree, that they'll call us. And that would mean that we're just going to get bigger. All right, so on the flip side of that, so New Orleans Fruit Tree Project's very small, very grassroots. My paying job is with the Second Harvest Food Bank of Greater New Orleans, Acadiana. This food bank serves 23 parishes and about 210,000 people each year. We have one of the largest geographic service areas out of the 200 food banks in the country. You can see to the west there, that's our southwest parishes, and the gray around the New Orleans area is our east parishes, which is funny that we're split up by the Baton Rouge Food Bank actually serves those parishes in the middle there. So like I said in the beginning, this is challenging, our low concentration of people with a very large geographic area. We have two warehouses, one in Lafayette and one in New Orleans. Food that is sourced, which is my position, is brought back to either those two warehouses where it is redistributed back out to the 400 food pantries, shelters, and soup kitchens we work with. So it's a lot of moving pieces when you're talking about that much land. We provide 25 million pounds of food through our network, which is a funny thing to talk about food waste. We definitely want, you know, food to stop being wasted, but a lot of that food that comes to us, so it's a funny thing. But a brief history of food banks. So you see in the 80s, they really started to appear in response to manufacturers producing overruns and a lot of excess food. Food banks, of course, doing the good that they do, also stepped up to take care of these overruns. As the industry gets more advanced, though, in the manufacturing, we're actually seeing a decrease in food donations from these donors. So as these traditional sources of food decrease, food assistance needs are increasing. So we're seeing reduction in SNAP benefits, stagnant poverty levels, and rising costs of food, utilities, and housing. So I just want to go over some of the areas that we do source food from, and rather successfully. This graph here is my concentration. We get food from the USDA. We purchase products when we need to. This is where my efforts are concentrated as the food sourcing specialist. So in the manufacturing field, this product has not reached consumer outlets. The product that we see is usually close to code. It's off spec. It's mislabeled or damaged. And that's important because there's a lot of education that goes on. Like Emily was saying, with our donors, that they know if something has passed its close to code or is close to code, they can call us, and that our guidelines and the way that we vet our donations are going to be followed as safely as possible for our clients, because they want to do good, but they also want to avoid any trouble. So a lot of education goes into working with our donors as well as our clients so that they know that product is safe. And like Emily was talking about, that bill is incredibly important to us. Retail is one of the areas that we've expanded into, like I said, as the traditional sources are changing. Retail has become more and more important, and we're finding that the product that we're getting from retail source streams is incredibly valuable. It's perishable products. It's meats, it's dairies, it's produce. This type of food sourcing is a little labor-intensive and a little bit more expensive. To work with that, we actually have agencies that we have partnered with picking up directly from retailers, takes us out as the middleman, and it gets that product to where it's going much faster. And like I said, the increased frequency of pickups, which agencies often are able to do if they have the resources, means more perishable products, which means better food for their clients. And you can see that kind of retail is taking up a lot of our donations. That graph would have looked a lot different probably 20 years ago. Agriculture is my favorite, not surprised probably, and this is the area I think we have the biggest potential. We are starting to work with farmers to address those issues of where the cost benefit or not benefit lies when pulling that food out of the field. How much does that actually cost? And if a food bank, such as ourselves, which is rather large, can cover those costs and retrieve that food, how do we make that happen? So we actually have a relationship with a couple of farmers that we're able to provide. We're not making anyone millionaires, but we're able to provide something called a value-added processing fee. And what that means is that we're able to provide 5 cents, 10 cents for every pound of food that the farmer pulls out to cover their seeds, to cover their labor and fertilizer, their water. They're not going to make money, but at the end, they'll be providing great product to the food bank. So that's our Mr. Liuza. He's one of my farmers up on the North Bank. In 6 weeks, we've gotten over 30,000 pounds of produce from him. So it's been a really great fall. And you can see in southern Louisiana, our agriculture industry isn't that prosperous. I mean, it's not that great for commercial crops. It's mostly rice, sugarcane, sweet potatoes. But to find the commercial crops, you just got to dig a little deeper. So in conclusion, grassroots efforts and large organizational models and effective legislation surrounding food rescue are necessary to reduce waste and increase food accessibility. Thanks.
Thank you. Wow, it's so inspiring what you're doing. You've got a lot of great work going on in the city. So our next speaker is Danielle Nierenberg, and she is the founder and director of Food Tank, which is an organization that does a lot of projects related to food and does a lot of amazing communication related to food. She has 200,000 people following her on Facebook and about the same number on Twitter, so she has a tremendous reach with her work. She previously worked at World Watch, and she started a project there, which she then spun off called Nourishing the Planet, where she went around the world and looked at really powerful and interesting and innovative solutions to agricultural needs in order to provide food and strengthen agricultural production. And I am very pleased to introduce Danielle.
Good afternoon, everyone. So just to give you a little bit more background about Food Tank, we're a research organization that's really devoted to convening individuals like yourselves, events, research, and content to push for food system change. And I want to thank the organizers of AFA for allowing me to stand in for Dana Gunders. I have some big shoes to fill there. I want to especially thank Ronnie Neff and our other presenters, Emily and Megan, for their contributions to this work. You've listened today to some of the foremost experts on food loss and food waste in the country. So let's give them a round of applause because they really deserve it for all the work they're doing. And I also want to thank each of you for being here because I don't think it's any exaggeration to say that everyone who comes to a conference like this, you're really on the leading edge of the movement for a better public health and food system. So I want to thank you for all the work that you do. As Ronnie mentioned, over the last few years, I've had this incredible honor and opportunity to travel and interview hundreds and hundreds of farmers and researchers, scientists, development workers, NGOs, and many others who are involved in the food system and really collect their thoughts about what's working on the ground to help alleviate hunger, obesity, food loss and food waste, poverty, and a whole range of other agricultural and environmental issues. And it really gave me a unique opportunity to hear firsthand what they think's working on the ground in their own countries. And after spending all of this time on the ground, I'm really convinced that the way things are in the food system, especially around food loss and food waste, isn't the way that they have to be. I'm convinced that we can build a food system that doesn't treat farmers and the natural environment as obstacles to sustainable growth, but really realizes that they're the preconditions for it. A food system where science is our servant and not our master, and where it's understood that costly, complicated technologies aren't always the most appropriate technologies. And a food system that really honors our values, where farmers and women and workers and other sort of folks who haven't been focused on in the food system all have a seat at the table, and no one is left on the outside looking in. And again, I'm especially pleased to be on this panel around food loss and food waste because really for me, from my perspective, food waste is the low-hanging fruit in the food system. There are so many great solutions out there. We've heard, you know, a lot of them today, and they don't cost a lot. They're often very easy to implement. A lot of it's around education, and a lot of it's around very simple, low-cost infrastructure. And I also, as we've heard this afternoon, you know, there's unprecedented waste going on, and most of us don't realize it. In the United States, we generate an extra 5 million tons of household waste each year just between Thanksgiving and the New Year holidays. And during that time, we also waste 3 times as much food as we do during other times of the year. So it's just a good reminder during this season of excess to keep a close watch on what you're buying and cooking and eating. And I think, you know, you don't have to be religious to recognize that we're wasting all of this food. 40% of the global harvest isn't feeding people. It's going to waste. So just another good reminder this time of year. You know, in the United States, as Emily pointed out and Ronnie too, we're wasting a lot of food because of overbuying, this misinterpretation of best buy and sell by and expiration dates. But in sub-Saharan Africa and other parts of the developing world, an equal amount of food is lost because of things like poor infrastructure and the lack of storage containers and the inability for farmers to protect their harvests from pests and disease. And so all of the hard work that farmers do to irrigate and fertilize and take care of their crops goes to waste and plunges a lot of them further into poverty. Food loss tends to be insidious, so a little bit happens in the field, a little bit happens in storage, a little bit happens in transport, and then a little bit happens in our homes and at businesses. And while it presents, you know, this amount of waste presents this big moral conundrum, as Ronnie pointed out, it also presents a lot of environmental problems, including a huge impact on climate change because of greenhouse gas emissions. But again, I want to get to the good news, and that's really the idea that preventing both food loss and food waste can be both simple and inexpensive. And we've heard a lot about practices in here in the United States and in New Orleans that are really inspiring and really exciting. But for someone like me who's, you know, been traveling around for a while now, the most innovative projects are really coming from the developing world. And one thing to remember about these projects is that a lot of them are happening without much funding and not much government support. They're just sort of cropping up because there's a need for them and people want to make change. So I'm just going to give you some examples of some projects that I've been able to visit. In the Gambia and India both, I visited farmers who were drying fruits like papayas and mangoes, helping make sure that their families not only had access to vitamin A throughout the year, but also a source of extra income through the sale of dried fruit. In Eastern Africa, the organization 1 Acre Fund is helping farmers learn how to keep better track of where their crops go and what is lost. And they've developed some very simple tracking sheets that help farmers understand how much food is grown and how much is wasted from one harvest to the next. And these tracking devices, along with the better use of storage materials, have really helped these farmers earn more from their crops from year to year. In Rwanda, the organization Heifer International is working with the nation's dairy farmers to establish these cooling centers so that farmers can take their milk from rural areas, drop it off at these cooling centers so that it can be shipped in a way that it doesn't go to waste to urban centers and other villages. In Pakistan, the United Nations has helped farmers reduce grain storage losses by around 70% by replacing some poor storage methods, just drying grain on the ground or using drying mats and racks to help them prevent moisture and rats and other vermin from destroying their crops. One thing I'm really excited about is that international donors and research institutions are really taking on the issue of post-harvest loss. The World Vegetable Center, for example, works both in Asia and Africa with farmers through really participatory research practices. The farmers help the researchers identify which varieties of vegetables are most hardy, like tomatoes that have thicker skins so that they can be transported longer distances on bumpy roads and not be destroyed by the time they get to market. And they're also working with women farmers in particular to find more palatable ways to preserve vegetables, including tomato paste, dried vegetables, and other products that can really help preserve harvests and also earn better incomes for these farmers. And I think Ronnie talked about earlier this cult of freshness that we have in the United States. And what we have to remember is that we, you know, drying foods, preserving foods in other ways can be a huge source of nutrition, not just in developing countries, but here as well. On the policy side, I think it's very important to push governments around the globe to do more on this issue. In 1974, at the first World Food Conference in Rome, there was a call for a 50% reduction in food waste over the coming decade. Obviously, we didn't get there. We didn't do much in the last 40 years to really prevent post-harvest losses and food waste. And, you know, I think we have a real opportunity right now to invest more in these strategies. As I said before, international institutions and governments, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa, but all over the world, really have this moment in time where they can take on these issues and invest in basic infrastructure like roads that will really help get their farmers get their harvest to market before they go bad. And again, earn more income and help lift themselves out of poverty. On the international policy side, there's something being developed right now called the Milan Protocol, which calls for more action on healthy lifestyles and preventing obesity, changes in investment, including banning food price speculation, and the issue of food loss and food waste. In 2015, during the Milan Expo in Italy, governments, businesses, and individuals from around the world will be called to take action on these issues, and particularly on food loss. The United Nations Zero Hunger Challenge is another very exciting international policy because it calls for zero loss and waste of food, and there's a real hope that next year when the world decides on the new sustainable development goals that will replace the Millennium Development Goals, that there will be a concerted effort to prevent food loss and food waste. I'm going to end and remind us all that we can all be part of the solution. You know, as Ronnie said earlier, we haven't always wasted this much food, so we don't have to keep doing it. And, you know, just a good reminder that we all can do something. So I'm just going to give you some points to take home. Don't buy more than what you can eat. Store your produce properly. Take leftovers home, which my partner does not like to do. He won't eat them. Don't throw away food that hasn't gone bad. And trust your senses, not expiration dates, as Emily pointed out, to let you know when something isn't good to eat. And then finally, we really need to push lawmakers to do more to prevent food loss and food waste, and also the businesses that we interact with every day, whether it's grocery retailers or restaurants. Huge portion sizes at restaurants are a big part of this problem. So voice your concerns with these folks and let them know that change needs to happen. Again, really honored to be part of this panel, and I'll look forward to the discussion.